The Vilna Gaon, Rabbi Eliyahu Kramer, is one of the most historically significant Jews of the last 1,000 years. His genius is beyond description, and his impact on Jewish life reverberates until today. In this class, we talk about the life and legacy of the Vilna Gaon. As always, please like and share this podcast, ask a question, or leave us a comment. Welcome to the Jewish History Podcast. I'm Rabbi Nachum Meth. The Vilna Gaon. If you want to study the sun, you can't look at the sun to study it. Obviously, it's too bright. You can't study the sun by looking at it. If you want to study the sun, you could do one of two things. You could put on some really strong sunglasses, very powerful filters, which basically lower the power of the sun, so that you can filter it so that you can perceive it. You filter it down so that it's now it looks like a regular light or a regular candle. But if you don't have that filter on it and you just look at the sun, it's just too bright, you can't perceive it. So that's one way you can study the sun, is by kind of filtering it down to a level that we can comprehend. Another way of studying the sun is not by looking at the sun, but looking at its secondary effects. I'm not going to look at the sun, but I'll look at the floor and I'll see how the light from the sun colors, shades, distorts, gives texture to the things that it illuminates. The Vilna Gaon is a perfect example, or a metaphor, using the sun is the perfect example for studying the Vilna Gaon. To try to really study the Vilna Gaon, to try to actually look at him, the person, and try to understand who he was and what he accomplished, is virtually impossible. It's like trying to look at the sun and trying to make heads or tails out of it. And in this class, we're not going to attempt to look at the Vilna Gaon directly, but what we're going to attempt to do is use those two techniques. We're going to give a quick biographical sketch of the Vilna Gaon, with a very important understanding that it's a filtered perspective of his biography and of his actual personal life. We're not really trying to sum up the Vilna Gaon by saying he started here, ended there, and here's what happened in the middle. It's a very filtered approach and a very filtered biographical sketch of who he was. And then what we're going to do, perhaps more importantly, is we're not going to really look at the Vilna Gaon himself, but we're going to look at his legacy. By understanding what he accomplished, what he touched, what he illuminated, we'll get a better sense of who the Vilna Gaon as a person was. Again, as by way of introduction, the Vilna Gaon stands out historically, just really jumps off the pages of the history books, Jewish history, for two reasons. Number one is in his era, during his times, he stood out in relief to everyone around him, as compared to his society, the people, and there were giants in Jewish history that were alive at his time that he was associated with. The Vilna Gaon just stands out. It's an interesting thing. He stands out, like we talk about quantity. You know, quantity and quality. The Vilna Gaon, in his generation, stands out not just quantitatively. Well, all the rabbis studied 100 pages and the Vilna Gaon studied 110 pages. It's not a quantitative difference. He qualitatively, it's like he belonged in a different generation. He did not fit in to the life and times and era that he was a part of. That's abundantly clear from everyone who discusses him, the people, colleagues, associates. The Vilna Gaon just stood in relief to everyone of his generation. And number two, a second reason why he really just stands out is, you know, we talk about Judaism, and we talk about the Masorah, we talk about the tradition, we talk about the last 3,335 years of Torah and the chain, the Masorah, the connection taking us back to Sinai. And of course, every single Jew is a part of that sacred chain. Every single Jew is part of that tradition. And of course, there are rabbis and there are leaders and people who inspire. And of course, that's true. There are a couple of people in the history of Jewish history that were beacons. They were not just great leaders and mentors and inspirers, but actually Jewish history, in a certain sense, goes through those individuals. There are only a handful of them, maybe a half a dozen, going back, you know, 3.5 millennia. talk about the Rambam. You talk about Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. And you talk about the Vilna Gaon. Last 1,000 years of Jewish history, Judaism goes through the Vilna Gaon. Period, hard stop. He is a beacon of the transmission and the tradition of Judaism. It just goes through the Vilna Gaon. That's not something you would say about some of the other great, historically important people. They had their place and they were vitally important and had their contribution. Judaism, as we see it today, goes through the Vilna Gaon. That was particularly important. Particularly important. It's the Vilna Gaon, who lived during the 18th century. I would call it in pre-modern times. As the world would move into the 8th to the 19th and 20th centuries, it was a time of tremendous upheaval in the Jewish world, both internally with many social revolutions, many social changes that swept away great numbers. A tumultuous decade, a century was the 19th century. And of course, the great tragedies that befell the Jewish people externally during the 19th and 20th centuries. And what's remarkable is that at the end of the 1700s, when the Vilna Gaon was alive, it was also in those pre-modern times, Judaism was teetering. Judaism began wobbling. It dealt with its own instabilities. And the Vilna Gaon was there to plant Judaism firmly, anchor Judaism firmly, and lead Judaism into modern times. And I think it's because of that, when we talk about the Vilna Gaon, when you think about what he did and what he accomplished, in many senses, he was the anchoring force of Judaism as Judaism entered into the modern times. Think about the United States of America. Think about the age of Napoleon. Think about modern times as countries become industrialized and modernized. All of those forces which would rattle the Jewish people in unprecedented ways, the Vilna Gaon anchored the Jewish experience so that we would not be toppled by all of those powerful forces that would hit Judaism. So let's take a minute. We'll first go through a brief biography of who the Vilna Gaon was. And then part two is we'll look at his legacy, some of the things that his illumination shined upon. Vilna Gaon was born in the year 1720. He would die the year 1797. My dad, blessed memory, would always say, if you want to think, just historically, it's always good to like line people up so it gives you perspective. He's always think, when you think Vilna Gaon, think George Washington. It's right around, again, give or take a couple years, a decade here, a decade there. But if you want to think the Vilna Gaon, he's living the lifetime roughly of George Washington. He's born in Lithuania, and he would spend most of his life in the town of in the city of Vilna, which is now Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania. That was his home, that was his place. He was born to a distinguished family. Very little is known about the details of his parental home. His mother's side, he was descended from Rabbi Moshe Rivkus, the author of the Ber Hagola, for those who study. The Ber Hagola is a classic commentary, more of an index of the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. And his father's side, he was descended from Rabbi Moshe Kramer, a legendary member of the Vilna Rabbinate. His name, we call him the Vilna Gaon. His name was Rabbi Eliyahu. His father's name was Shlomo Zalman. It's my father's name. Eliyahu ben Shlomo Zalman. He's called the Vilna Gaon. What does that mean? Vilna is the town that he came from. What is a Gaon? So a little bit of Jewish history. After the times of the Talmud, when the Talmud was completed, year 440, 450 of the Common Era, and Jews were living in modern day, Iran and Iraq, Mesopotamia. The Jews were living in that area, Persia, and that's where Judaism would flourish for the next half a century. There were the leaders of the Jewish community, were the leaders of the yeshiva of Pumpadisa and Sura. These were the leaders of the Jewish people of the next 500 years. The head of those yeshiva, these were the pride of the yeshiva. Everyone was so proud of these scholars and these great people. They were the pride of the town. Word for pride in Hebrew is gaon. Gaon means pride. And this period is actually referred to often in Jewish history as the gaonic period, because they would call the head of the yeshiva the gaon. He was the pride. The word took on a different meaning. If you were a gaon, you weren't just the pride of the town, you were also a genius, because you couldn't get that job without being pretty smart. And the term gaon, which is usually strictly associated with that period, the year, let's call it 500 to the year 1000, roughly, We call it the Gaonic period because the Gaon was the leader of those academies. Colloquially, throughout history, the word Gaon, always say, oh, he's a Gaon, Benny, he's a Gaon. That means he's a genius. And people have often been given the appellation, he's a Gaon. But there was only one Gaon. The Vilna Gaon was the pride of Vilna, but he was also a brilliant genius. And that's where he gets the name, the Vilna Gaon. That's where it comes from. When people say the Gaon, they mean one person in Jewish history. They mean the great Gaon of Vilna. He's actually referred to in Jewish literature more often than not. He's called the Gra. Has anyone ever heard of that? The Gra. Gra is an acronym for Gaon Rebbe Eliyahu. The Gra. So if I by accident slip into, you know, that term throughout this lecture, and I keep on, I'm saying the Gra did this, the Gra did that, I mean Rabbi Eliyahu, the Vilna Gaon. His last name was Kramer, Rabbi Eliyahu Kramer, the Vilna Gaon. He had many children. Sketching his biographical story, he had many children. Many people today can trace their ancestry to the Vilna Gaon. That's actually a very common thing, and I'll actually bet you many people in this room are a direct descendant of the Vilna Gaon. It's actually not so surprising. If you think, I don't know, I'm going to make it up, he's maybe 12 generations back. Ashkenazic Jewry during that period wasn't all that big. We all probably descended from, you know, if you're an Ashkenazic Jew, you share a lot of ancestry in common. He had a lot of children. A lot of people can trace their roots through the Vilna Gaon. The reason why people know this is because he was such a towering, dominating person. So people kept that in their memory. Oh, I'm a descendant of the Vilna Gaon. His genius and brilliance is literally the stories of legends. And I'll share some of the stories and the legends. Some of them are true. They're probably mostly true. They definitely paint the picture. We're talking about a person who, as I mentioned, you can't look at the sun. We're filtering it down. Here are some of the stories that they say. By 4, he had memorized all of Tanakh. That's all of scripture. At 7, he was taught Talmud by Rabbi Moshe, by four years old. By seven, the story goes at 6 and a half, when he was 6 and a half years old, his father brought him into the shul. And Rabbi Katanik gave him, you know, he spoke in front of the shul, Rabbi Katanik, and he blew the rabbi away, 6 and a half years old. And the rabbi said, I'm not impressed, because he probably just memorized what his father taught him. So his father said, watch this trick. And he had him study like some new sources, some others, 6 and a half, and he gave a totally new presentation, totally undoing what he did, on the spot, with like an hour to prepare. By the age of 13, his great student, Rabbi Chaim Volozhin, wrote some biographical sketches of the Vilna Gaon. He wrote that by the time he was 13, he mastered the Talmud verbatim, word for word, knew the Talmud, but not just that. That was the Babylonian Talmud, the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Medrash, the Rambam, the Tur, and many Kabbalistic texts as well. He didn't just stop when he was 13. As he became older, I mean, his memory, again, I was actually doing some reading, but there's no such thing as a photographic memory. But if anyone ever had a photographic memory, or just a memory, a retention that was beyond belief, it was the Vilna Gaon. Something that, like, we can't relate to. Again, we're looking at a filtered image of the sun. One of his great students, Rabbi Shklov, would say that the Vilna Gaon would review all of Torah once a month. That's the entire Talmud, everything. Again, entire Talmud is the type of thing that takes most people a lifetime. Have anyone heard of the Daf Yomi system? Daf Yomi, where you do one page of the Talmud a day. It takes 7.5 years to complete. And most people, I don't mean this disparagingly, most people when they study Daf Yomi, they're doing a very, very shallow, cursory reading of the Talmud. To study a page of the Talmud properly takes hours, a week, easily, to really study. The Vilna Gaon did the entire Talmud in depth every month. Before Sukkah, the story goes, the things that are written by one of his students, painting a portrait of just his genius. Story goes that before Sukkot one time, one of the Vilna Gaon's students, or a couple of his students, came before the Vilna Gaon on Sukkot, and the Gra told him, they encouraged everyone, they should memorize one tractate in the Talmud. It's a good idea to memorize, have one tractate memorized. Why? Because very often, you're going to be traveling, you're going to be away, and you're not going to have an actual book to study from. But he said, if you have it memorized, if for whatever reason you don't have a sefer, if you don't have a volume to study from, I know one tractate by heart. And you'll never be like, you'll always be able to study something. Just review it in your mind. And he encouraged everyone, try to commit one tractate to memory. Now, trying to commit something to memory like that it's doable. It is doable, and people do it today. It is, you have to use mnemonic tricks and all sorts of stuff, but it's very hard. So one of his students decided, okay, I'm going to do it. And he spent a lot of time. He memorized tractate Sukkos. Tractate Sukkah. He memorized it. And he went in front of the Gaon, in front of the Vilna Gaon, and he said, Rabbi, you know, Rabbi, my teacher, I memorized it. And the Vilna Gaon said, you want me to give you a bechina? You want me to give you a test to see how well you know it? He said, sure. All right. This isn't going to end well, right? So he asked this student, how many times in Tractate Sukkah, how many times does Rabbi Meir argue with Rabbi Yehuda? How many times does Rabbi Akiva argue with Rabbi Tarfon? How many times are Abaye and Rava's name mentioned in the entire tractate? That's like impossible. It's like reading a phone book and saying, how many times does the name Johnson appear? Like, I don't know. Of course, the Vilna Gaon told him, he says, well, I think you should study it again and get back to me. And he told him the answer. He then asked, again, it's like a cute trick that the Vilna Gaon was able to do. He said, how many examples, you know, the tractate Sukkah deals a lot about the qualifications, what makes an actual Sukkah that you sit, remember, you sit on the Sukkah, on the booth. There are laws of what makes a Sukkah kosher. There are laws of what situations where a Sukkah is unkosher. He said, if you go through the Talmud, but not just the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, if you go through the Talmud Yerushalmi, Tosefta, Sifran, Sifri, which is all the Midrashic literature, how many different examples are there in the entire corpus of the Torah of kosher sukkahs? How many examples does the Talmud and all the Midrashic literature give? How many examples of kosher sukkahs are there? Guys, I don't know. He said, well, the number is 91. There are 91 such sukkahs that are mentioned in Kol HaTorah Kula, which is the gematria, the numerical equivalent of the word sukkah spelled in full. Samach Vav Chaf Hey, which if you are familiar with the gematria system, which is a numerological connection, the word sukkah actually corresponds to the 91 examples found in the entire Talmud of kosher sukkahs. He then said, well, how many invalid sukkahs are there in Kol HaTorah Kula? How many invalid sukkah examples are brought in the entire corpus of the Torah, body of Torah? I said, I don't know the answer to that either. The Vilna Gaon said, I'll tell you. It's 85 corresponding to the numerological connection, the gematria of sukkah spelled chaser. Sukkah missing that vav, samach chaf hei. These type of stories like this of the Gra, of the Vilna Gaon, are legendary and common. I feel it's worth just emphasizing that we shouldn't, again, going back to that example of we're looking at the sun in a filter, through filtered glasses. You hear a story like that and you think, okay, he just had Google in his brain. He was just able to type. It's like some kind of like database research. He didn't just have this enormous reservoir of information with a miraculous form of recall. It was his quality as well, the depth. In other words, we have AI technology. You can ask the AI, how many times did the Talmud, all right, so he was just a couple centuries advanced. He had AI in his brains. Yeah, I think it's a step deeper. Again, just trying to get a glimpse of who he was. For example, AI technology is very limited. If you ask AI, I don't know, don't try this at home, ChatGPT, write an amazing story. Paint a picture. That's where AI technology will usually break down when it comes to something that's artistic. Like a really good, compelling novel, AI can't really do. I mean, I'm sure it could do it, but I don't think that technology is quite there, because it's not just, AI is really good at breadth, but depth, something that's compelling and deep, that's a different muscle, it's a different skill. When we talk about the Vilna Gaon, let's not limit him to him. Wow, he just had a tremendous breadth of knowledge. His depth was probably even more impressive than the stories that they tell over of the Vilna Gaon. Aside from his brilliant genius, which is, again, unfathomable, he was called, ironically, and you'll see why in a moment, he was called the Chassid. Now, when we hear the word chassid, we think of the guys in Williamsburg with the long coats and the beards and the word, and we're actually going to see that's going to be a major, major part of the Vilna Gaon's life. hold that thought for how the Vilna Gaon interacted with the Hasidic movement. The word Hasid in the 18th century just means pious. That's really what the word Hasid means, is pious. The movement, the Hasidim, they just use that word, and it is the word that we use to identify a social movement or a religious movement called the Hasidic movement. But the actual technical word Hasid means pious. The Vilna Gaon was called a Hasid because of his tremendous piety. This is the story that's written by his children. The Vilna Gaon slept 2 hours a day. But not even in full 2 hour increments. He would sleep in half hour increments. So as to make sure he maximized his time studying Torah. He barely ate. They say that every year before Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, he would do a cheshbon nefesh. He would do a personal reflection, how much time he wasted the whole year, to the minute. It was usually under 3 hours. The year.
I waste 3 hours and 4 hours.
They write, one of his students told an amazing story just to get out of his piety. We'll see, the Vilna Gaon was given a stipend. That's how he lived most of his life. He was supported by the town of Vilna. They supported him. Maybe let's just jump to that for a second. He never had any position, ever. He was not a rabbi of a town. He was not a rabbi of a shul. He never had a yeshiva. He never even really had proper students. He didn't have students in the classic sense. He just sat and studied. He studied and lived the life of Torah. Now, eventually he would develop something that was called the Vilna, the Klois, which was like a small little, Klois literally means a closet, but it was like a small house in old Vilna, and that's where he studied. People used to come and learn from him, and he had many students in the sense, they didn't even call themselves students in the proper sense. These were people who gain knowledge and inspiration and tradition from the Vilna Gaon, but he never had any real position. The people of Vilna, who recognized that this was a tiring individual, Vilna, which was really the capital of Lithuanian Jewry, so they gave him a stipend because they realized they had such a spiritual, person, such a holy man. So they gave him a stipend. Apparently, at one point, the gabbai, the person who was designated to deliver the gra, the Vilna Gaon, his stipend was embezzling the money. But the Vilna Gaon never told anyone because he didn't want this guy to feel bad. He didn't want to expose him. He just let it slide. Which meant the Vilna Gaon, who was not a very wealthy man, he didn't work. He was basically surviving off of the charity of the community, and he wasn't even receiving that. But he didn't want to shame this person. His life was a life of Torah. If you want to, encapsulate the Vilna Gaon into one thing, one idea, was a life of just pure Torah study and pure Torah advancement. It's very, very hard to try to really understand what that means. Like, if you're not like in Torah, just to appreciate what he accomplished and what he did, it's very difficult. A couple other small biographical notes that we know of the Vilna Gaon: when he was right around the age of 30, he went on a self-imposed exile. This was not an unusual, it wasn't the most common thing, but people used to do this. It's not clear why he did this, but he went on a personal exile where he bounced around Eastern Europe, even went as far into Western Europe and places like that. Most people, the theories are, it was a form of penitence. Form of, when you're living on the road and you're an anonymous person, no one knows who you are, you're not treated very well. And it was a way, if he felt, it was a way of penitence for something. That's one theory. Another theory goes, and they probably are all true for to some degree, he did accomplish these three things. So one was just penitence. Another one was that he was trying to discover hidden geniuses, hidden leaders amongst the Jewish people, and who he could inspire and motivate. Like, he's just staying in Vilna. Maybe there's a Jew in Paris or something. I don't know if he went to Paris, but certainly went to Germany. There might be a Jew in Berlin who he might be able to inspire to become a rabbi, an inspirer, a leader, a mentor. And that was one of the things that he did while he was on the road. And thirdly, as we'll see, is one of his legacies. He took it as an opportunity. Manuscripts were very difficult to come by in the 1700s. If you want to get the correct text of Tosfos, of Rashba, of the Rambam, of the Torah, really of the Talmud, errors would creep in, and this was a way of gathering textual evidence and scholarship to amend texts, which we'll talk about in a moment. He had a very few events in his life by a way of like a direct narrative. If you want to tell the story of the Vilna Gaon, there isn't all that much. maybe two or three things that are notable. One will be his big fight against the Hasidim, which we'll talk about in the second section about his legacy. That would be one thing, a major thing that happened in his life. The other thing, which is interesting, hard to know how it fits in. Apparently, there was a big challenge. Vilna, as I mentioned, was a big Jewish town, many shuls, but there was a chief rabbi of Vilna, and it was in the 1760s or 1770s where there was a bit of a controversy over the chief rabbinate of Vilna. When the chief rabbi had died, his son wanted to take over that position. Now, that post wasn't just, you know, being a rabbi and giving sermons and leading the congregation and telling what page the Shemona Esrei is on. It actually had certain political elements attached to it. And apparently the son wanted to take that position. But the community, it was divided. The Vilna Gaon was like one of the only few things that he actually got involved with. He actually was on the side of not having the son being the rabbi. And indeed, the way the story ended is, I don't know if it's wasn't really a compromise. The way it ended is that for the next 150 years, Vilna had no chief rabbi. That doesn't mean there weren't rabbis in Vilna. There were many rabbis and scholars and mentors, but there was no chief rabbi until right around World War I, where that changed, and that was a whole controversy in and of itself. So that was really the only other thing that the Vilna Gaon actually got involved with historically. Another interesting point, two other interesting stories. He attempted later on in his life to emigrate to Israel. He tried to move to Israel. It didn't work. His papers weren't in order. He got stuck. After about 2 months of travel, it didn't work. And he returned home. He said it was Simon Min HaShemayim. It was clearly from heaven that they didn't want him to go, but he did attempt to make it to Israel. He was jailed at one point. It's not clear why. He may have been jailed on numerous occasions, but the story that we have is that there was a Jewish apostate, a Jew who converted to Christianity. He was a young child. For whatever reason, he converted. And some of the local Jews abducted him, brought him back into the fold to try to re-educate him. They were successful. The Christians didn't like that. And the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, was jailed for a couple of weeks. The story goes, it seems to be confirmed, the story is while he was in prison, I think this is in Maaseh Rav, which is one of the stories, biographies of the Vilna Gaon, he was imprisoned over Sukkos. Over the holiday of Sukkot, our leader, teacher, and rabbi, may he rest in peace, when he was imprisoned on Sukkot, tried with all his strength and walked from one place to another and held his eyelids open and made an extraordinary effort not to sleep outside of the sukkah. There's a tradition, halacha, you don't sleep outside of the sukkah. He's in prison. He tried to stay up, you know, for the entire Sukkot so that he wouldn't sleep, so he wouldn't sleep outside of the sukkah until basically his captors decided this guy was meant business and they got him a sukkah to stay in. Eventually he got released. So eventually the Vilna Gaon dies in the year 1797. He was buried in Vilna. The Vilna Shul and the Graz Klois, that room, that place that he studied, were significantly damaged by the Nazis in World War II and then were destroyed by the Russians in the 50s. The Gaon's Kever, his cemetery, his tombstone and his plot, was basically plowed over by the Russians. The ancient Jewish cemetery of Vilna was defiled and desecrated by the Russians and turned into a shopping center and I believe a sports stadium as well. But the small, tiny Jewish community that was there, they were able to somehow figure out a way, and they moved him to the other cemetery in Vilna, and may God take retribution on the enemies of the Jewish people who would dare to desecrate our ancient past and the Vilna Gaons and all the Jews of Vilna. That's the brief biographical sketch of the Vilna Gaon. Let's try to move on to the other section, his legacy. Let's see, to try to capture a picture, to try to understand who he was by studying the things that he illuminated, studying the people or concepts that he impacted. By far, his greatest legacy was what he did for Torah study amongst the Jewish people, particularly in Poland and Lithuania, and by extension to us even till today. It requires a little bit of background. I'm going to zip through things that really are worthy of their own discussions. Poland, as a Jewish community, and maybe just back up. When we say Poland, nowadays we think of Poland. There's a country called Poland. There's a country called Lithuania. There's Belarus. There's the Ukraine. Back in, let's say, the 1500s, the beginning of the 16th century, Jews really began emigrating from Central and Western Europe, the Rhineland, Germany, and they had been harassed and persecuted for centuries in those regions. They were welcomed in Poland because Poland was and still is a very backward place. And actually the kings and the rulers felt that bringing in the Jews would actually improve their economic profile, which it did. That's always the story of Jewish history, is the countries that actually say, hey, Jews, we want you to come here. Those countries tend to flourish because us Jews, we know what we're doing usually. And who knows why, all right? The Jews control the world. I guess we do. I don't know. But they wanted the Jews to come. And they did. And beginning in the 16th, really in the, you know, in the 16th and 17th centuries, Poland, we'd call it almost like the golden age of Torah in Poland. The 16th century and the 17th century, Torah in Poland, and by Poland, this is the point I want to get to, Poland means Lithuania as well, and parts of Belarus and Ukraine. We're all part of the Poland and Lithuania merged. There was really one kingdom, and it would stay that way till its division, the partitions of Poland, which took place at the end of the Wilna Gaon's lifetime. In the 1790s, Poland ceased to be a country. Poland wasn't a country from 1791, 93, 97. There were three partitions of Poland. Poland stopped being a country until World War I. But up until that point, certainly in the 16th and 17th centuries, Poland was, it just took over. It became the capital for Torah knowledge. If you open up any standard edition of the Talmud, you will see in the back of the Talmud a commentary of the Maharam, a commentary of the Maharsha, a commentary of the Maharshal. These were the giant, towering Torah scholars who just, I mean, all of Judaism comes through Poland. They were just dominating forces. You look at the great codes, the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, who is the Ashkenazic version of the Code of Jewish Law, and all the commentaries written on the Shulchan Aruch, as well as on the Torah. These are a who's who of Polish Jewry of the 16th and 17th centuries. The Sma, the Shach, the Taz, the Drisha, the Prisha, the Bach, and the list just goes on, and the Magen David, the Magen Avraham, these were towering people. And Judaism just flourished, but it wasn't just the rabbis at the top. It wasn't just a bunch of elitists. The average Jew in Poland during this time, Torah study was ubiquitous. It's one of the golden eras of Jewish history. It was the amount of Torah that was studied in the 1500s and 1600s in Poland and Lithuania. It was everywhere. Torah scholarship was respected, was put on a pedestal. But two things really happened that jeopardized and destabilized the centrality of Torah in Poland and Lithuania. Number one would be the terrible pogroms of 1648 and 1649. Gzeras Tach V'Tat, which is, we've talked about, really is a whole discussion, a whole lecture in its own right, was one of the worst pogroms in the history of the Jewish people. We think of the Holocaust, and it was obviously the Holocaust was the greatest tragedy in the history of mankind. But 1648 and 1649, there was a peasant uprising led by an evil man named Bogdan Khmelnytsky, who destroyed Jewish communities. Hundreds of thousands of Jews were likely killed. Communities were destroyed. And it laid the Jewish community after 1648. If you think about it, Jews had been economically stable in Poland. Judaism flourished. It was stable for 150, 200 years in Poland. And it came crashing down 1648 and 1649. The upheavals, the external, just the practical upheavals are not to be imagined. It was for sure in Ashkenazic Jewry, the greatest tragedy from the time of the destruction of the Second Temple till the Holocaust would be the 1648, 1649 tragedies and pogroms. It destabilized Judaism in a very, very, very significant way. Number two, this is a little bit of a technical point, but it's important to understand. As Judaism and Torah flourished in the 1500s and 1600s, a style of learning, a style of Torah scholarship began to emerge. It's a style called pilpul. You may have heard that word. It's often used in yeshivas nowadays. When we talk about pilpul nowadays, pilpul literally means, what is
discussion, the back and forth.
What's the, does anyone, any modern Hebrew, what does the word pilpul mean? Pepper. A little spice, right? The literal word pilpul is pepper. So nowadays, when we talk about pilpul, it just means it's like a very thought-provoking, deep analysis of a Talmudic text. That's what we mean. It's usually, in circles nowadays, when we talk about pilpul, it's usually considered a good thing. It's when we get really in deep in something. It's you get spicy on the Talmud. It's amazing. In the 1600s, the late 1600s and early 1700s, a style of Talmudic learning, confusingly, called pilpul began to emerge. It's not the same pilpul that we talk about today. Pilpul back then were building these huge towers in the sky, castles in the sky of Talmudic analysis, connecting 101 different sources and showing how A connects to B and connects to C and connects to D. And they were lofty, soaring concepts, which number one, the average guy couldn't follow. And number two, whoever could follow, you really weren't, it was detached from the pursuit of MS. They oftentimes were just not, they weren't true. They weren't true. They were interesting theoretical connections, but they missed that component of Torah study is usually a pursuit of MS. We're trying to get to the truth. These types of analysis were creative, imaginative, but hard to really feel that this is actually what was going on in the Talmudic discussion. Because of this pilpul, the soaring elements of pilpul, you didn't feel like you were actually getting towards truth. Torah study, people, at least for the masses, didn't begin. They stopped enjoying it as much. They weren't engaged quite as much as it used to be in Torah study. The Vilna Gaon, one of the things that he did, and one of his great legacies, was a stabilization of Torah for the masses. Think about it. After 1648, 1649, because the Jewish community was so shaken externally, people just abandoned. They didn't put the same weight and priority and emphasis on Torah study. Because of pilpul, people didn't even find it that satisfying, or it wasn't really as part of them. The Vilna Gaon really fought against pilpul and said, let's get back to the basics. Let's get back to the beauty and joy and simplicity of the profundity of good old-fashioned Torah study. And it was sort of a restabilization that he did. And Torah study, and it was really because of the Vilna Gaon that this pilpul style really went out of style. And Torah study really got re-anchored back to the masses. And indeed, after the Vilna Gaon, beginning in the 19th and 20th centuries, again, Lithuania would be the home of Torah study in Judaism. By far. The 1800s and 1900s, Lithuania and parts of Poland, those were the primary regions. Again, Central Europe had its places, Western Europe, even Hungary and the Sephardic countries, they obviously, Torah was a priority, but they were dwarfed by a huge scale by the Torah scholarship, particularly in Lithuania, to a lesser extent in Poland as well. Another thing that happened where the grudges historically, where the Vilna Gaon fits in, is we've talked about in the past one of the great debacles of Jewish history was the Shabtai Tzvi debacle. Everybody remember the Shabtai Tzvi debacle? He was a false messiah. Philip claimed to be the messiah in the late 1600s. It was a very painful experience in the Jewish, I guess in Jewish history. A lot of people thought this fellow Shabtai Tzvi, who was mentally deranged, they thought he was the messiah, but it swept away huge segments of the Jewish population. And it was very painful when the whole thing came crashing down. One of the problems, one of the ways Shabtai Tzvi was really able to elevate himself was through the study of Kabbalah. He emphasized Kabbalah, all these Kabbalistic mystical practices, and he did all of these mystical things. Mysticism has two things. Number one, it has a wide appeal. People are, by nature, common people tend to be very superstitious. And Kabbalism, spirituality, and mystical ideas can really be attractive to not such scrupulous people. People are swept away by superstitions and things like that. Mysticism and Kabbalah can really speak to those groups. And that was part of Shabtai Tzvi's effect, why he was so successful. As a backlash of the Shabtai Tzvi debacle, the study of Kabbalah certainly, to the masses, certainly in public, was heavily, heavily curtailed. many controversies would arise in the early 1700s of people who would be thinking about Kabbalah or be teaching Kabbalah, and they'd be accused of being Sabbateans, of being followers of the Shabtai Tzvi. Some of the most painful episodes in Jewish history. The great Rabbi Yaakov Emden, Rabbi Yonason Eichitz debates of the 1700s for a different time. It was all centered around Kabbalah. Kabbalah, there was a huge backlash against Kabbalah. And oftentimes, as things go in history, the pendulum swung too far. Because Kabbalah does have its place in Judaism. And that place is very secondary to good old-fashioned Torah, the Talmud, the codes, the Shulchan Aruch, the Halacha, the Musar. After a person has mastered that, there is a place, there is a concept, and there is makom, there is a spot in Judaism for Kabbalah. But it just has to be put in its proper place. After the debacle of Shabtai Tzvi, the pendulum swung so far the other way, no Kabbalah study, even in its appropriate setting, was criticized. The Vilna Gaon was the greatest Kabbalist of his day, by far. He was a tremendous Kabbalist, but he was able to put it in the right perspective, and he again restabilized Kabbalah and gave it its proper place in Judaism. Another one of his major accomplishments and legacies. Another one of the Gra's legacies, as we mentioned earlier, was amending the texts. If you go through the Talmud, the text of the Talmud and the Mishnah have to be precise, have to be exact, and errors can creep in to the text of the Talmud. The Vilna Gaon corrected a lot of the textual errors that had crept into the Mishnah and Talmud over the centuries. Now, people do that today. I'm a scholar. Oh, I found an ancient manuscript buried in the Vatican's basement. Now let's change all the Talmud. And you could be cavalier, you know, hiding behind scholarly, you know, garbs and start making changes. And that could be very, very, very problematic. The other extreme is we take the traditions that we have and they're sacrosanct, and we can't ever touch the text as well. That's obviously a mistake. What you need is someone who's a brilliant scholar, but someone who's also tremendously pious. And that was one of the things that the Vilna Gaon did. He made amendments to the text of the Talmud, but it should be not taken as some scholarly research. They were acts of piety. One of his great students would say, the Vilna Gaon, he would fast. Before any time he would ever make an amendment to the text of the Talmud, he would fast as a make sure that this is correct. So he appreciated what he was doing, and every version, the standard editions of the Talmud that we have today, the texts have gone through the filter of the great Vilna Gaon, and that's what we have. He left over many, many writings. One of his other great legacies are the books and the Torah that we have of the Vilna Gaon. What's interesting is the Vilna Gaon really didn't publish anything in his lifetime. Two things happened. His students wrote over a lot of his ideas and teachings. So anything that we have of the Vilna Gaon is either from his students, and by the way, they're constantly publishing new things of the Vilna Gaon. It's like, you know you're cool when they're publishing your stuff even when you're dead. Like that Vilna Gaon, like he was one of those guys that his stuff is still published. Number two is he wrote a lot of marginal notes. You know, like on the side of a book, you'd write a little note. The Vilna Gaon did that, particularly on the codes of Jewish law, on the Shulchan Aruch. And what's in every standard edition of the Code of Jewish Law is something called the Bir Hagra. Bir means the explanations, Hagra of Hagon Rabbi Eliyahu, the Vilna Gaon. The Bir Hagra, in my opinion, it's standard. You have to study them. They are impossible to read for three or four reasons. Number one, at least when I was studying for rabbinic ordination, you're doing these things, you're studying the codes, you have to read the Gra. Number one, it was always in a chicken scratch, tiny font. And I'm like, it was physically hard to read. Number two, and Rabbi Ketanik can attest to it, I don't know why, but everything in the Bir HaGra is abbreviated. Can you imagine, everything is abbreviated.
Even abbreviated.
It's unbelievable. So you have to, there'll be like seven words. Every single one of the words is an abbreviation. And you just have to, what is that word? You're just trying to actually read the words. Once you've figured out just literally the words that he's reading, you then have to figure out what is he saying. After you figure that out, then you're asked, why is he saying it? And there is probably no commentary. I think it's part of traditional Jewish studying and Torah studying that is so brief and is so jam-packed in four words. That's the entire Bir Hagra. That's why it's very frustrating to study. There is nothing briefer than the Bir Hagra, and it could be so cryptic, and then you have to unpack it, and that's what you do. It's very difficult. The Bir Hagra is probably his biggest commentary that's studied, although he left many, many, many commentaries. Historically, the biggest thing that the Vilna, of the biggest things that the Vilna Gaon was a part of was the great, fierce controversy between the Hasidim and the Misnagdim.
The Bir Hagra, he didn't actually write
the I don't think so. Double check me on that. I think the Bir Hagra were his glosses. His students and children published them. I don't think he published it. Okay. I'm pretty sure. One of the great controversies of the day was the role of the Hasidim against the Misnagdim. Again, worthy of its own discussion, and maybe at the right time we will, is the Hasidic movement, which began in the early 1700s. The Hasidic movement is hard to really define. It eludes description. It's more a movement of people than a unified ideology. But loosely speaking, in wake of the great tragedies of 1648 and 1649, in the wake of the depression that swept the Jewish people after the Shabtai Tzvi debacle in the beginning of the 1700s, the average Jew, the masses, were in a very depressed state. Judaism, for the masses, had just experienced very painful times, and I'm talking particularly in Eastern Europe. To fill that void, the Hasidic movement came. The Hasidic movement was a movement, roughly speaking, which emphasized prayer. It emphasized piety. It emphasized love of God, connection to God. And all these things are wonderful things, but it was a re-shifting. It was a re-focusing. It was not in the classic tradition of mainstream Judaism. Those things in and of themselves may not have been so controversial. But certainly back then, one of the biggest challenges, probably the biggest problem that the non-Hasidic world had, was the de-emphasis that the Hasidic group had on Torah study. They were more focused on other things in Judaism. And there are very important things in Judaism, no question about it. Of course, in Judaism, there are many, many points of connection to spirituality. But de-emphasizing Torah is a cardinal no-no in Judaism. The Torah is Kihem Chayinu V'Arachimenu. It is our life. It is the Jewish people. And that de-emphasis of Torah study within this Hasidic movement cast dispersion. Every great leaders looked askance on the Hasidic movement. Important point. When we talk about the Hasidic world today, we have to recognize it's very different than what the Hasidic world was in the 1700s. Back in the 1700s, it was this new movement. As I mentioned, it wasn't just one movement. There were many, many different ideologies within Hasidism. And Hasidism had many strange, unusual practices, especially in the 1700s, which led to a reaction of people who opposed the Hasidic movement. Opposed, in Hebrew, is to mitnaged, is to oppose. And the opposers of the Hasidic movement were called Misnagdim. Misnagdim now just means you're not Hasidic. But literally, Mitnaged means to oppose. The Misnagdim were those who opposed the Hasidic movement. Birosham, the leader of the Misnaged movement in the early years, in the first wave of Hasidism, was the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon was fiercely, fierily, if that's a word, opposed mitnaged. He was opposed to the Hasidic movement. And several cherems, excommunications, bans were issued against Hasidism, signed and authorized, according to most scholars, actually led by the Vilna Gaon, not just that he put his name on it. He was actually the driving force. The cherem that were issued, really highlighted a couple of practices that they found objectionable. Number one is that the Hasidim separated from the shuls. They used to daven in shtibels. Ever hear the word shtibel? I always say we have to take everyone on a field trip to see a good old-fashioned shtibel. You haven't experienced Judaism unless you've davened in a shtibel. A shtibel is like a tiny little, it's like a house. A shtub, what is it? Who speaks Yiddish around here? Where are Yiddish speakers? Vos meint der, what is a shtub? A shtub is a house. A shtibel, the E-L-E at the end of a Yiddish word is the diminutive. A shtibul is a small house. And this, they would daven in these small houses, these small rooms, but really what they were is they separated from the main synagogues. And the Vilna Gaon and the Misnagdim felt like you're being Porish Menatzibur, you're separating. That mere act alone of separating from the congregation in and of itself is inappropriate. Number two, the Chasidim changed the Nusach HaTfilah, the Jewish liturgy. They changed it. There was something called Nusach Ashkenaz, the classic Ashkenazic liturgy. That's how Jews in Ashkenaz of Ashkenazic descent had been praying for years. The Chasidim implemented certain emendations and changes based on the Sephardic liturgy and traditions, and confusingly to us, we have nowadays, I actually guilty as charged, I daven Nusach Sfar. Nusach Sfar means the Sfard liturgy, it's not Sephardic. Sephardic is a different thing. So there's Sephardic, Sfard, and Ashkenaz. If you're confused, don't worry about it. In any event, they changed the liturgy, and that was banned. How can you change? This is our sacred tradition. We daven, we pray according to this liturgy. They had many strange practices. Again, I want to emphasize and underscore yet again, Hasidim nowadays, the Hasidic movement nowadays, is not what Hasidim was back then. There were strange behaviors, somersaults, literally, people praying on their head upside down. There were reasons for it, and there were strange, bizarre behaviors as things got more and more into whatever this movement was. And they said that these strange behaviors during prayer, strange social behaviors, and most importantly was the general movement away from the centrality of Torah. And the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, issued these excommunications, these cherems, these bans. Was he successful? Strictly speaking, the answer is no. He didn't succeed. Look, Hasidism, it thrives today. It flourishes today. You'll even find, I was just thinking yesterday, Rabbi Katanik, hopefully you'll appreciate this. If you look at the relationship between the Misnagdic and Hasidic world, I've developed the meth theory of Hasidic Misnagdic interactions. It goes through four waves. In the 1700s, it was excommunication. In the 1800s, it was polemicization, if that's a word, polemics. Even the Vilna Gaon student, great student, Rabbi Chaim Balazhin, he didn't really adhere to the excommunication. And excommunication means you can't be in the same room as the guy. That didn't happen. They just wrote polemics. The Nefesh HaChaim, one of the great works of, the great work of Rabbi Chaim Balazhin, in a sense is a polemic against Hasidism. But the excommunication didn't really last. They went to a different, in the 1800s, it was into polemicization. In the 1900s, toleration. The difference between the Misnagdic world and the Hasidic world, they tolerated one another. You go into the 2000s today, it's, I would call it integration. Where does the Hasidic world end and the Misnagdic world begin? It's virtually impossible to figure it out. It's been totally blurred. Those are the meth theory of Hasidic Misnagdic interaction. It's actually very good, right? Is that good? It's actually pretty accurate. It's very good. I thought about that last night while I was on the bike. Thank you very much. Hopefully someone in Harvard will give me a PhD for that one. But what's interesting, so in one sense, the Vilna Gaon, the Gra, was unsuccessful because he was of that first wave. But even the great Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the great Chabad Lubavitch Rebbe, he himself, who actually tried to visit the Vilna Gaon to try to plead the case of Hasidism, try to have the Gra rescind his excommunication ban, the Vilna Gaon wouldn't even see him. He didn't want to see him. That's how stridently the Vilna Gaon was against Hasidism. Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi would write the Vilna Gaon as the greatest hero for Hasidism, the greatest savior. He saved Hasidism. Because if not for the Vilna Gaon, indeed Hasidism would have gone off the rails. The Vilna Gaon was actually remarkably successful. He saved Hasidism. With his strident, fearful, forceful excommunication and ban, it forced the Hasidic movement to look inward, re-examine, maybe what the Vilna Gaon is actually saying is correct, and they had to realign themselves, and now you fast forward till today in 2024, I think the Vilna Gaon probably in heaven is smiling at the Hasidic Misnagdic, I mean, I don't know, it's hard for me to know, but it's not nearly where it could have been. That you can have a universe and a situation today where there's integration, he saved Hasidus from going off the deep end. Hours late, but maybe just touch on a few other points and we'll call it a day. The Vilna Gaon actually had a tremendous secular knowledge. He wrote a book. I forget what it was called or was published. What he translated Euclidean geometry. He was brilliant. There's a story where he had a physician. He had an eye problem. And the physician came in. And Vilna Gaon didn't want to have a doctor treat him. And he said, you know, in Judaism, we believe in going to doctors. And the Vilna Gaon said, yeah, but I'm only going to go to a qualified doctor. And the optometrist said, I'm a qualified doctor. And the Vilna Gaon said, really? How many vessels are there in the eyeball? And the doctor's like, oh, I don't know, 23. And the Vilna Gaon said, there are 70. And that's what the word, how do you say I in Hebrew? Ayin is the numerical value. Ayin is a Hebrew letter which corresponds to 70. The Vilna Gaon just said that he actually identified what those 70 blood vessels were. And after the ophthalmologist didn't know what to do, he says, I'm not treating, you're not going to be my doctor. Someone told me, apparently, or Isaac Scher says over that apparently in the 60s, science had just discovered the 70th eye vessel, a blood vessel in the eye. There actually are 70. Again, I don't know if it's true or not, but that's the story that they say. There actually are 70 eye. He was a brilliant mathematician. This is an important point. My dad always used to say, he had heard, anyone remember in your algebra 2, Cramer's rule? Remember Cramer's rule? It's an algebraic formula. There's a Jewish legend that who discovered Cramer's rule? Rabbi Eliyahu Cramer, the Vilna Gaon. It's not true. It's highly doubtful it's true. It's some other guy named Cramer. I want to just flag, this is an important point. You know, some of you might think, oh, Rabbi, a lot of legends about the Vilna Gaon. I want to share an idea. It's an important message. When the great historian, Rabbi Darrell Wine, living in Israel, he writes about legends. Legends are important even if they're not true. As long as we caveat, it's a legend. We don't know the veracity of the truthfulness because you have to be accurate. But once we state that, a legend has value because it could have been true. It paints the picture of who we're talking about. I don't know if the Vilna Gaon probably didn't invent Cramer's rule, but if he would have, it's not a surprise. Meaning, if they say Meth invented the Cramer's rule, no one would believe me because that's just not who I am. But if the Vilna Gaon was the person who discovered Cramer's rule, we'd be like, okay, that fits in line with his personality and his character. And that's why legends actually are valuable. The story goes when he was in Berlin, the great mathematicians in the university there had some mathematical problems. They bumped into Vilna Gaon, was there for a weekend. They asked him and he resolved all of their mathematical problems. He was brilliant. Sadly, revisionist historians in very recent times, there was a book recently published in the last like 2 years where they tried to revise the Vilna Gaon and turn him into a maskil and turn him into one of these people who were very big into secular and enlightened wisdom. It's not true. He was well-versed in secular knowledge, but not as an independent pursuit. These were all pursuits within the mainstream of having a better understanding of Torah. And we should be cautious revising history. Two last legacies and then we'll end, or three or two, is, as I mentioned, he wanted to go to Israel. He wanted to go to Israel. It was unsuccessful. However, his students did go to Israel. He had one of his several students, including Rav Menachem Mendel of Shklov, who would establish, for all of our Zionists, you've ever heard of the Yishuv HaYashan? Israel, we say, and it's important to really understand the true history of Israel. Jews have been living in Israel for the last thousands of years. It's true, but it's not really true. Before the 1700s, the amount of Jews living in Israel was minute, minuscule. There was a wave of resettlement in the 1500s in northern Israel in Tzfat, and it actually flourished for about 75, 80 years. After that, again, there were Jews living in Israel. It should also be noted, no one was living in Israel. It was an inhospitable land. Very few people were living in Israel. The Yishuv HaYashan, for all of my Zionist friends, the Yishuv HaYashan means the old settlement. The first real wave of modern settlements of the land of Israel was two groups. Number one were the Talmidei Hagra, the students of the Vilna Gaon. They reestablished Jerusalem as a town of Jews. There are Jews live. Jews were not really living in Jerusalem. It was established by the Talmidei Hagra, the students of the Vilna Gaon. Strangely, it were also Hasidic students, Hasidic masters who lived in Jerusalem. So if integration exists, is now the order of the day between Misnagdim and Hasidim. And actually, there was a microcosm of that in the early 1800s. The Hasidim and Misnagdim had to work together just simply to survive. And they did live together. But the Gra really is the proto-Zionist. He was the one that really began the modern settlement of the land of Israel. If you go to Israel today, you will note there are certain traditions that are different in terms of religious practice as compared to outside the land of Israel. The reason for that is the Vilna Gaon. When the Vilna Gaon students reestablished the Yishuv HaYashan, when they settled Jerusalem in the early 1800s, what traditions do they follow? They followed the minhagim, the traditions of their great Rebbe, their great leader, the Vilna Gaon. And that is Eretz Yisrael and Israel today. The minhag hagra reigns supreme. If you dare put on tefillin in Israel and Chol HaMoed, you will literally be beaten up. There's an ancient disagreement, matter of machlokas, tefillin or tefillin wars in the intermediate days of Shavuos and Pesach. Different people will do different things. Most non-Hasidic Jews do put on tefillin. You cannot and should not put on tefillin in Eretz Yisrael because the Gruz opinion was that you don't put on tefillin on Chol HaMoed, and no one, even in the privacy of your room, it's generally considered halachically inappropriate, it's almost disrespectful, because Eretz Yisrael, Israel was established according to the Minhag HaGra, and people don't wear tefillin. There are several other examples. Duchening, the priestly blessings, which are not done outside the land of Israel, except for on Halleis, in Israel are done every day. That was an institution of the Vilna Gaon. Many other parts of Jewish, not saying Vishamru, Friday night, for those who are keeping score. If you go to Yerushalayim, if you go to the real places that keep the Minhagei HaGra, the traditions of the Gra, no one sings Vishamru right before the Shemona Esrei Friday night, Minhag HaGra. There are many of these types of, not saying Baruch Hashem Liolam Amen Ve'Amen, for those who keep track on Mariv, no one says that in Israel. Again, Minhag HaGra, all from the Vilna Gaon. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, the Vilna Gaon inspired people to create movements. He himself was not the father of two of the biggest movements, the most identifiable movements of modern Jewish life. Number one, the yeshiva movement. We've talked about this in the past. The yeshivas, as constituted today, academies of scholarship, never really existed. There were always yeshivas, but not academies with formal curriculum that had staff, that had teachers. You had small yeshivas for generations, but they were just basically, a rabbi taught his students, and that was called a yeshiva. But an actual organization, an actual institution, which would A, survive generationally, B, had a curriculum, C, had multiple people on staff, was a new thing. It was created directly by the Vilna Gaon's prized student. His greatest student was a rabbi named Rabbi Chaim Volozhin, and he established the great yeshiva of Volozhin, the father, the granddaddy of all yeshivas. Any yeshiva that you've ever heard of or seen today is directly a descendant of the Volozhin yeshiva, which was the brainchild of the Vilna Gaon. And finally, the Musar movement. The Musar movement, the idea that part of Judaism and part of Torah incorporated within that is personal spiritual growth, is a direct result of the Vilna Gaon. As we've talked about classes of the great Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was inspired by his Rabbi, Rabbi Zundel of Salant, who was inspired indirectly from Rabbi Chaim Volozhiner, who got his inspiration from the Vilna Gaon. These great movements are such a defining feature of modern contemporary Jewish life, all have their direct antecedents from the Vilna Gaon. In conclusion, it's impossible, it's like funny, I usually try not to do biographical sketches of people who are, in a certain sense, so distant from us, like the Vilna Gaon. As I was driving over here today, I was like trying to think, what lessons can I actually, he's such a towering, untouchable figure, what lessons practically can we gain from the greatness of the Vilna Gaon? I think there are several. Number one, if not for anything, is to realize the godless Adam, the greatness of mankind. Look at what one person did. You literally cannot take the Vilna Gaon out of Jewish history without the entire story falling apart on itself. He is such a defining part of modern Jewish life. It should really be an inspiration, the koach of a yachid, the impact that one person can have on the course of mankind is just unfathomable. And that's really the story of the Vilna Gaon. And secondly, perhaps more importantly, with all of his greatness and all of the things that he accomplished, and from a historical perspective, just how significant a person he is, it all boils back to one thing. The centrality of Torah. That was the real legacy of the Vilna Gaon. That the Torah is indeed, ki heim chayenu v'arach yameinu, that the Torah is the defining part of Judaism. You cannot take Torah out of Judaism and expect Judaism to work or to last. more than a few generations. The Gra, the Vilna Gaon, reestablished and re-anchored the primacy of Torah. He re-anchored the centrality of Torah, and Judaism is impacted in just every possible way by the work and strength of this great man. I want to thank you all for coming. If anyone has any questions, I'm here to stick around. Thank you for listening to this edition of the Jewish History Podcast. As always, we'd really appreciate if you like and share this podcast, or even better, leave a comment. For more information, please visit us at www.lasvegaskolel.org.